Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. Join us in a vibrant conversation about the constant struggle to find balance between the demands of their careers and their relationships with money, family, and personal freedom. This isn't just about money. This is about life. Now, here's your host, Lynn S. Evans.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lynn S. Evans, and I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. We should know that personal finance isn't about being rich or getting rich quick. It's about buying independence and freedom of choice. You are not alone as you struggle with being the perfect wife, mother, daughter, daughter-in-law, and all the other traditional roles assigned to us by our culture. These pressures can feel overwhelming, and when we add the demands of a career on top of it all, many women choose to pass on dealing with money issues until they're forced to, and that is not the best time to learn. Here we explore the stories of women and how they've handled the demands of finances, family, and career. We talk about falling short of perfection, but also about the lessons we've learned and the best advice our peers have to offer for financial security and for putting our perceived failures in their proper place. My mission is to help women have a healthy, positive relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is Sharon Torek of the Torek Law Firm. Welcome, Sharon.
Thanks, Lynn. Great to be here with you today.
Let me just let everybody who's listening get a little idea of your background. So she is the principal of Torek Law, where she focuses her national law practice on helping professionals in the advertising, marketing, and creative services industries protect and monetize their intellectual capital and manage the legal implications of their marketing and advertising work. Sharon provides proactive, strategic counsel to communications, marketing, advertising, and creative agencies on legal and business issues they face continually in their work, including agency-client relationships, agency-freelancer relationships, trademark and brand protection matters, social media and content marketing legal compliance, copyright protection, licensing and transfer of creative content, and advertising law. She's a nationally recognized author and speaker to advertising and communications industry organizations, marketing agencies, and in-house marketing teams, and has created and presented numerous training sessions and conference presentations to industry professionals on timely industry legal issues. That's pretty much of a tremendous accomplishment there.
Yeah.
It was good to read that.
Thank you.
I like that. Very good. So let me start by asking you something about your chosen profession. To me, it's always been a very interesting set of events that happen in somebody's life that makes them move towards one particular area of career versus another. And there are many of us, myself included, who actually went to college for one particular career choice and ended up being 180 degrees opposite from that. So I'm just curious to know what your background was, your educational background, and why you made the decision to go into law.
You know, it's I sometimes struggle with which part of the story to tell, really, but I'll go back to when I was deciding on attending college, still in high school as a junior or senior. And not only was the first female in my family, I'm the oldest sibling, first of all, first generation college attendee, and one of three daughters. So when I told my father that I wanted to go to college and major, and this wasn't that long ago, so it's pretty remarkable that I'm the first generation of college attendees in my family. But when I told my dad what my selected major was, which was political science, which is in terms of marketability, one of the silliest majors you could probably choose, although it's a tremendous major for other reasons. He just looked at me and said, "What do you want to do with that? Be a lawyer?" And, you know, trying to sell it to him as best as I could, I said, "Yeah, sure, okay, I'd like to be a lawyer." So, you know, a career in political science studies at undergraduate school was born. And as I started to study, you know, I always had an interest in public policy and in problem solving and how the law related to that. So I can't really say that I always grew up wanting to be a lawyer. I really cannot say that. But I did have a huge interest in solving problems, being a trusted confidant and resource provider to solve problems for other people. And so really, as I navigated through undergraduate school, that led me to one of two paths. It was either going to be some sort of public policy career path, or it was going to be a private law practice career path. And so I took a couple years to work after undergraduate school, and my first job ended up being in a law firm. And that sort of gave me some access to what the business of working in a law firm was like. And I worked at a really great firm at the time, and so decided to go to law school from there on. So that's sort of my path.
Mm-hmm.
Really started more as a sales pitch, I guess, in some ways, but ended up, you know, getting me to a place where I felt like my talents best aligned at the time.
And then,
of course, since then, you know, it's taken a lot of twists and turns.
Yeah.
Lawyers' careers do. I find that lawyers end up doing a lot of things with their legal background, not necessarily always practicing law.
And how did you get into this particular area of law? Because it's really wide open. There's not a whole lot of precedence for much of this world that we're talking about, especially with it now being online.
Yeah.
So how did you, I understand that any kind of intellectual property law has been something that's existed for several hundred years. But how do you make that move into this world, which is kind of like the wild, wild west out here? You know, there's every day it's kind of like something new, because you have cybersecurity issues, you have intellectual property copywriting issues, you have people stealing things left and right. I mean, how do you manage that?
Yeah, I come into providing counsel to firms in the marketing communications ad industries sort of via my background in intellectual property. I got a lot of really great training in my first law firm job, which was a paraprofessional position. I was a paralegal. Then I worked with the firm's intellectual property lawyers and really got to learn about the legal constructs behind intellectual property and really enjoyed that practice and got learned a lot of practical skills there. So I started my first law practice just as a solopreneur, hung out a shingle, took all kinds of cases, but always had this strong background in intellectual property law, trademark law in particular, helping clients protect brands, register brands, deal with infringement on brands. So I think it was the trademark and copyright aspects of my knowledge set that sort of led to me getting a lot of business in the marketing and advertising field. There were lots of marketing and ad agencies that started interacting with me more. I got very active in our local trade organization in Northeast Ohio, which is a chapter of a national network of advertising professionals, and that snowballed into an intellectual property and marketing law practice, because not only did these folks have a lot of brand trademark and copyright questions, but that sort of led into some of these other legal issues dealing with social media compliance and contracts between agencies and clients about how to deal with these things. And so basically it was a further narrowing down the funnel from intellectual property law in general to IP and marketing law to IP and marketing law for marketing agencies. So I found that I think this is an important point for any of your listeners who are in a professional service. The narrower you can squeeze that down the funnel, the better you do, because you become more unique and you become more efficient at spotting patterns and what your clients need and, mm-hmm. and developing the talent and tools you need to address them. So that's kind of how we got to where we are now, based on, you know, really my first job and what I learned. I could have very easily have been put in, you know, the bankruptcy or the employment law departments at this firm, because it was a huge firm. But this is sort of where my path led me. And the industry I work in is underserved with legal talent, which is great for me, but provides me lots of opportunities to do education and content creation. But it's also really fun. I mean, the creativity that you get to interact with, and the crazy ideas that come your way, and even some of the fires you have to put out are just very unique, and, you know, they need the help, and they're fun to work with.
Well, now, without, you know, mentioning any particular clients, we don't want to do that, but is there anyone in particular, any situation that you can recall that really tested your abilities to be able to do some things that would, as I said, you're kind of in the wild, wild west in some of this stuff, but
yeah.
where you resolved something that you thought that was really great. I'm so glad I put that together.
You know, there's tons of unique situations. One that just comes to mind quickly is working with an agency in the western part of the United States who had a freelance creative person on their team, so someone who was not employed by them but who was an independent contractor, who ended up ultimately being exposed for having plagiarized some pretty significant work that had been then given to clients, two different clients, and then deployed by those clients out in the marketplace without anybody but the freelancer knowing that this work had been plagiarized.
Wow.
So I would say that was one of the more unique and challenging situations that I've had to address, because we had to do quite a bit of sleuthing to find the original rights owners of this work, obtain permissions, pay for those permissions, and make sure that we got everybody on sound legal footing. And there's lots of details that I'll leave out of the story, but sort of writing the situation for our client, who was really a middleman, if you will, in the situation, making sure that their clients were protected, and then holding accountable on the individual who was responsible sort of for all this, was a pretty big project for a client without a huge amount of resources to throw after it. So we had to be efficient. We had to be nimble. That's probably one of the more tricky situations we've had to navigate. But there's been a lot of I think some of the more rewarding projects we've also worked on is putting together, you know, brand new processes or toolkits or resources for our agency clients to address specific situations, like putting together an entire compliance program for an agency on all of its legal matters, putting together a training program and compliance toolkit for social media and content marketing for another of our agency clients. So I much prefer to be proactive in my practice and give clients tools in advance to avoid fires rather than having to see them spend their resources on putting the fires out. Of course, we do that when we need to, and sometimes you don't have a choice, but I love creating proactive solutions for them in advance so that they're well-equipped to deal with situations as they occur.
Sharon, let me ask a question here that's, I mean it in a general sense, not necessarily that you have to tell me about the specifics of any case. But when you find something like you just mentioned where it clearly is plagiarism, mm-hmm. and you would go after the person who stole the property, how does one determine damages is there some kind of a formula that you use when you come up with what's the financial damage to this firm because somebody stole something?
Well, you know, in general, it's a function of whether or not you've, how you've protected yourself in the first place with respect to the assets that have been misused. The copyright law is very specific on how you recover damages and attorney's fees based upon whether you've protected your work with copyright registration before the infringement has occurred. So if you've done that, you're in the best possible position because you can collect statutory damages. And those are usually more significant than any actual damages you're likely to be able to recover. Because to recover actual damages, you have to prove what the value of your work is. It's very hard to do, especially if you're talking about one isolated piece of work. You know, proving that it actually has commercial value is a challenge. It's not impossible, but it's a challenge. So it's a good lesson in being proactive about protecting your work in the first place. Absent the ability to pursue statutory damages, which can be up to $100,000 per work, depending on the circumstances.
Wow.
And also recover your attorney's fees, which copyright statute also allows you to do if you've got a registered work. You really have to put on evidence or have evidence available about what the commercial value of your work actually is. And I'm going to be candid and say that in most cases, the expense and cost of having to develop that evidence and pursue that infringement for only actual damages is frequently not worth the cost of going through the process. So kind of a business decision at that point. And sometimes you can handle the situation by negotiating a license without having to actually pursue an infringement case.
Oh, yeah. So do people really know what is something that they need to protect? I mean, in a proactive way? I mean, I think a lot of people go into things, and I'm just thinking about people who start businesses, and yes, they have to go through the usual channels of fictitious names and clearing that and all that good stuff. But then beyond that, what are the things that are copyrightable? I mean, how does one know that these are things that aren't part of the general lexicon or something? And you say, you know, I'm thinking of one in particular, and I can't remember what it was. I think it was Xerox. That Xerox, it became a verb. Like Google is a verb now in our language. But once it gets past the point where it's not a trademark anymore and it becomes part of the lexicon, how do you protect that as the original owner of the name?
Right. You know, I'll try to be succinct because this is something we could really, I mean, I spent entire days training on this. Most business owners, and let's take entrepreneurial business owners as an example, people who own smaller or mid-sized companies or solopreneur practices, you mostly have intellectual property in one of three forms, and you may have all three. You've got a trademark, which is your brand, either the brand of your business overall or the brand associated with a particular product or a service that you sell. That's the word or the logo that when people hear it or see it, they associate what you sell with you. Then there's your copyrights. And your copyright is a set of rights that somebody has in some original creative work. It could be a film, it could be a painting, it could be a piece of software, it could be a novel. And that includes the rights to sell it, to display it, to change it, to use it on your website, whatever that might be. These are the set of rights we refer to as copyright. And then you may have trade secrets. And this is information that is of economic value to your business because it's held privately, and it gives you some competitive advantage in the workplace. So most small businesses have one, if not all, of these. And how you protect these assets is a function, really, of prioritizing what resources you have to allocate to protecting them, and how integral they are to your business overall. You know, the trademark is really your first priority in most cases, because you need to protect it and get a jump on it so early these days with the internet. You want to pick a brand that is not only usable as a product or a service or a company name, but it has to be available online. You want to, you know, you want to sew it up on all your social media platforms. So because it's so complicated these days to get and find and use a good brand, that's usually where I recommend the clients start. And then there's all the screening and the due diligence that has to be done, ideally before you adopt the brand. So that's trademark, copyright. It really depends on what business you're in.
Okay.
A lot of people have copyrightable assets that don't necessarily think that they've got copyrightable assets. And a lot of people assume that copyright protects your ideas or your processes and sort of the way you do things, and it doesn't. It's a specific something that's in a very tangible form.
Okay. So
I warned you. I told you we could go down.
No, I know. No, I'm just thinking that those of us who are business owners are probably sitting here thinking now about what is it that's copyrightable about what I do, and should I be doing things now rather than later? And, you know, once you get to a certain level of recognition, whether it's even local or national, you expose yourself to more of that. So, and then international, I guess, with the internet, you're walking all over all kinds of legal landmines. So I don't know how you do this, but I'm glad you said what you said, because it's going to make those of us who are business owners start thinking about this, and maybe we need to do some more work on that.
And I would say, if you're a knowledge-based business, even if you're a small knowledge-based business, you need take a look at the things that the value you're really providing to your clients and how you provide it. If you're a consultant and you do training sessions, what sort of materials are you producing? Are you producing workbooks? Are you producing slide decks? Do you have a manual? Do you have trainer notes? These are the kinds of things you want to look at through the lens of copyright protection. Whereas the how we do stuff, those are things maybe you want to keep close to the vest and try to protect as trade secrets, or maybe they're not protectable at all because they're very generic in nature.
Yeah.
So I'd say start there from the perspective of, you know, copyright and IP. And the second tip I would give to all of your listeners is that in this gig economy where we are all relying upon the talents and help of independent contractors or freelancers, I think the most important takeaway for your listeners is that unless you've got something in writing with these people that says you own the work that they do for you, you do not own the work that they do for you, even if you paid for it. That's the way the copyright law works. And so very critical in these sort of, you know, solopreneurs like to be very informal in the way they work with people. They don't want to bring a lot of payroll obligations onto themselves, so they'll work with freelancers and things like that. You need to take steps to make sure you're getting the ownership to that work transferred to you in writing on a regular basis.
That's a very, very good point. I think a lot of us, as you said, solopreneurs, you just go out there and do it. You don't think about this stuff. But
right. That's
really what you have to do to protect yourself. Let me move this around to a different perspective here. You mentioned before that you were one of several of your siblings who were part of the first generation who went to college.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your family life when you were growing up. Where were you in the birth order?
I'm the oldest of three girls. I have two younger sisters. Yeah, I mean, you know, our family life was, my parents were divorced when I was at a very young age, although my dad always was in the picture. He lived just a short couple blocks from us. But it was, you know, it was a typical example of working class to bridging into that middle class life that a lot of us, you know, in America at that time knew. My parents were both very hard workers.
Mm-hmm.
Money was not abundant, but we certainly were not poor in any way. I'm sure there were struggles that we didn't see as children. I probably saw more of them than my younger sisters did, because I think that's pretty normal.
Yeah.
In a family, the oldest child is usually a little bit more perceptive than the next, and so on and so forth. But learned tremendous lessons about work ethic and about the value of independence from both of my parents, which is probably why for the majority of my career I've been self-employed.
Yeah.
I learned self-actualization and resourcefulness because of the lessons that they taught me, or that I, you know, learned observing them.
What was your first memory about money?
I guess my overarching early memories about money is that there was never enough of it, it seemed like.
Yeah.
And then secondly, I can remember, because for quite a while when we were young kids, my mom was a waitress in restaurants, and actually made a really good living doing it, because she worked at very upscale places. But, you know, at the end of the day, there always ended up being small bills and change in the bottom of her handbags. And so one of my earliest memories is my middle sister and I foraging through all of her old purses. And just doing a land grab for all the money to put it in our piggy banks.
That's funny.
We occasionally would do pretty well, you know, or what felt like pretty well, because my, you know, always a lot of small change left over there. But I guess it's one of my more tactile early memories of money.
That's a riot. So yeah, do you put it in your piggy banks?
Yeah. Or, you know, I guess I was more of a spender. My mom always used to say I was a spender when I was a little kid. There was always something I wanted to get, you know, uh-huh. But.
And so so when you got your first job, did you actually spend the money that you made, or did you save some of it? How did you develop your way of being around money?
I would say a little bit of both. I would say, you know, if I have to be honest about myself as a kid, and probably my more base tendency as an adult, I've probably been more of a spender than a saver by instinct. Naturally, you tamp that down as you get older and you have more resources to protect. But my first job and my absolute favorite of all time jobs that I've ever had, including the one I do now, was working in it was not my first job. It was my second job. I had a first job, which I positively hated, which was working at a restaurant. This is my second job, and it was in a major department store nearby our home, in a mall that was sort of, you know, where all the kids hung out. And I was really great at it. I was very young, 16 years old, and I was excellent at selling. And so I got to work in really the best departments in the store, and they eventually put me down in the human resources office, and, you know, I got to help with interviewing people and determining who would work where, and it was pretty heady for a high school kid. And
yeah,
I continued to work there in college as well, and actually met my husband there, because he worked there when he was in college also. So that was the most fun I've ever had in a job in my life. Great people, loved being, it's probably why I still, my favorite shopping experience to these days remains being in a traditional department store.
Yeah.
You can actually put my hand on the stuff and see how it's merchandised and all that good stuff.
So you don't do too much on QVC or things like that?
Never been a TV shopper, no. I do shop online when I have to these days. But
yeah.
My preference is to really actually see and look at the merchandise. It gets harder to do that as, you know, as time gets shorter.
Yeah, and as stores keep closing.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true.
So what's been the most threatening to your financial security?
You know, I would say overall, what is threatening and is bad for anybody as they're developing their career, their financial wealth, their portfolio, is staying in a situation that doesn't suit you for too long a period. And the reason why I say that that is financially threatening is because ultimately you're going to end up putting yourself and keeping yourself in a box that's not going to enable you to grow personally, professionally. And if you can't do that, you're not going to be able to reach your earning potential. So I would say what's been most threatening is maybe a few times in my career staying in professional situations out of loyalty or whatever that, you know, past the point where I should have made a move earlier.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's something that makes sense. I think a lot, I don't know if that's, I shouldn't say that I think that is the case, but I think women tend to do that more than men because we, you know, we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings and we
have
a sense of loyalty, you know.
Loyalty, right? I think some of it, although this wasn't my personal case, I think some of it is fear or security based,
yes.
You know.
Yes.
The devil you know sometimes feels safer than what you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I stayed in situations longer than I should have out of fear. I can say that I probably stayed in situations maybe past my ideal expire date because of loyalty. So I think that it's important to know that anything that impacts your ability to grow personally, this is just an opinion of mine, but I think anything that impacts your ability to grow personally is going to ultimately have an adverse effect on your earning ability.
Yeah.
And so it's a financial issue as well as it's a personal growth issue.
On that topic, what would you say are some of the best and the worst financial decisions you've ever made?
Well, I think in addition to the one that I just mentioned about, you know, staying in a situation longer than you should, probably, you know, as a young woman, being a little too free with spending and credit, I think that that's something that can snowball and end up impacting you longer than you realize at the time, just because it's very easy and frictionless to accumulate debt and not easy and frictionless at all to get out from under debt. So I would say in my earlier years, those are probably the mistakes I made most frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And best decision, being in business for myself. It helps you, I think, even though you're taking more risk on, I think it helps you understand your financial picture so much better. And I think it's so much more motivating to be responsible for your own financial success when you're not limited by anything except for your own ability to get out there and make it happen.
And how did that go over with your parents, being self-employed?
Being self-employed?
Yeah.
You know, my father was a lifelong business owner himself. I mean,
okay.
My father, you know, to give you sort of an illustration about where I learned my work ethic, my dad, until he retired just a few years ago, had a full-time business and a full-time job simultaneously for probably over 35 or 40 years. So for them, and my mother owned her own business for a short period of time as well. So for them, knowing that they taught me independence and resourcefulness, they were both supportive. I never felt a lick or lack of support from either of my parents. And I was already married at the time I went out and practiced for myself. And my husband was completely supportive as well of that.
Good.
Yeah.
Let me ask you another question here. Who was the most influential woman in your life?
Well, my mom had a tremendous amount of influence, in my life, still does. I would say in addition to her, I had one high school teacher. She was my advanced placement English teacher, who I think more than any other teacher I'd ever worked with saw the potential in me I was not someone who went through all 4 years of advanced placement classes. I probably was someone who had untapped potential and, you know, began sort of living up to it later on in high school. And she, more than any other teacher, really saw the potential in me and sort of nurtured it. And the reason why I feel she was influential is because what she said to me was that she had other students in my class, my senior advanced English class, who were naturally talented, naturally gifted, like she thought I was, but they weren't willing to put the work in.
Yeah.
They were not willing to work as hard as they could to use their talents to their fullest potential. And she saw in me a willingness to work, to use whatever potential I did have. And there were definitely were smarter kids than me in that class, for sure. But I was willing to work harder than they were.
Yeah.
And she noticed that. And she noticed that in me, and that made me want to even work harder. So she was very influential in terms of the way I saw myself as a learner and the way I saw my intelligence.
And I see that you are involved in a lot of organizations in the Cleveland area, and one in particular is called COSE, C-O-S-E.
COSE, yeah, the Council of Smaller Enterprises.
Tell us about that. What is it and why are you so involved in it?
COSE is the small business resource arm of our Greater Cleveland Chamber of Commerce, which is called the Greater Cleveland Partnership. And it is an advocacy and resource organization for small businesses that does things like education, networking, has a very robust benefits provision program, which is sort of one of its legacy products. And it really helps to make sure that small businesses are well represented in the economic development agenda in our region, helps them connect them to each other, and then provides products and services at discounts for them as well. And I've been on the board of COSE for a long time. I'm a former chair of the board of directors. It's been a couple of years since I ended my term there, but I'm still on that board, as well as the board of the Greater Cleveland Partnership itself, which is the chamber organization.
Okay. One last question. What area of personal finance are you most uncomfortable with?
I've got to admit to not enjoying the regular grind, the day-to-day, the month-to-month grind of looking at your financial picture. I'm perfectly happy to sit down with my financial advisor. Planning for the future doesn't scare me. Looking at the numbers doesn't scare me. But it's, as I'm sure any of your listeners who run their family finances as well as the finances for a business, perhaps, staying on top of all those things, I'm perfectly talented at it. I just don't enjoy it. So
okay.
I would say that's my biggest, probably, obstacle is just not enjoying keeping on top of those bookkeeping type details. They're a necessary part of, having a healthy financial life and certainly of having a healthy business. But they're not what I enjoy about what I do at all.
Well, that's a full disclosure, and that's fine.
Just being honest.
Yeah, because some people will dance around that one, but the reality is you're very honest about it. You hate that part of it.
And yeah, I do it. I love it.
Now, it's good to know that, because I think people who are listening probably, in many ways, a lot of entrepreneurs hate that nitty-gritty stuff that they have to do every day, but not too many of us want to actually acknowledge that, because we're supposed to be just, so well-rounded as business owners that we have something all the time taking care of all this kind of stuff, and there are people out there that can give you at any moment, their profit margin, their net worth, and anything else. But the majority don't, because they're too focused on what their business is and how much they like what they're doing.
Right.
So
I do any of those things. It's just not what I enjoy about what I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, all of you, my Power the Purse community, these were invaluable insights and perspectives from my guest, Sharon Torek, all of which can help you move your career, your life, your relationships, and your financial freedom forward. Thanks again, Sharon, for your time and knowledge, and tell my listeners how they can get a hold of you.
Thanks, Lynn. You can certainly get a hold of me by email anytime. It's Sharon@legalandcreative.com. On Twitter at Sharon Torek, T-O-E-R-E-K, or on my websites, which are legalandcreative.com and agencylegalprotection.com.
Thank you. And for everyone out there listening, until we speak again, have a good one. Goodbye.
We hope you've enjoyed your time with us on this episode of the Power of the Purse podcast. If you're ready to take action, go to womenofsubstancellc.com/call and sign up for an exclusive 15-minute one-on-one call with your host, Lynn Evans. Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.